benefits and risks of meds, and how do we do something with the trainees in all the professional fields of the teens who don't seem to get enough of the message?
So, Julie, thank you for your compliment and also for your important question. A big challenge. And obviously that's an industry that's going through quite a bit of upheaval at the moment on its own. And in this transition, in some ways that may be more difficult for everyone, because when people are fearful, they're sometimes more challenging to deal with, I'll put it that way. I'm impressed by how many students have always been against this. I mean, from the day I started medical school, which was just 10 years ago, there was almost immediately a student saying, you know, we should give back these stethoscopes that Lilly gave us or whatever. Somehow they get socialized out of that. But what's different now is there's a lot more faculty pretty much sounding that drumbeat as well. That's not to say they don't make good products. Sometimes they make fantastic products. The issue comes down to precision application. And on some level, what excites me about comparative effectiveness is the notion of not saying we want to be a gatekeeper to all these breakthrough treatments, but that we want to find out who really benefits, whose life, function, and so forth has really changed dramatically, and make sure they get it. We don't have the "and make sure they get it" part now. TV ads, et cetera, notwithstanding, a lot of whether you benefit from a breakthrough treatment or new innovation depends a lot on where you live, who your networks are, and a lot of luck. We could do a much better job on the pushing it out to those who would benefit, and frankly spare other people the cost, expense, and everything else. Now, will that message be, how would I say, reframed and reworded? Sure. But I think ultimately what leading companies are recognizing now is they've got to compete on real value added. That's not where they've been, and it doesn't make this transition fun for them or for us either. Yeah.
I apologize for coming in.
Like, stand up here.
Hi, I'm Gail Bellamy. Lots of different questions. One of them, though, I was going to go rural, but instead I'm going to go with the notion of death panels. Mm-hmm. The idea of comparative effectiveness, of our desire to learn more about what works for different patients, what doesn't work, and how within the political framework within which your agency really tries to help us with that, that is being reframed in very negative ways. How do we help dispel the insanity?
Well, it is very, very tough. And I must say, particularly with the work that we support for the Preventive Services Task Force, they make the judgment calls about grades and so forth, but you know, we're supporting the science and inevitably linked to what they're doing. And now, of course, their recommendations are linked directly to policy, exemption from co-payments, and so forth. I can say that we're learning a lot. I don't know what works politically, to be quite honest. You know, early on I watched the secretary on TV talk about how important an advance directive had been in her family when her mother died and how helpful it was. And it became clear even before she was finished that this was actually not going to work. And she wasn't in a particularly noisy show. I'm stymied. At the same time, I'm really encouraged by the response to the recent PSA draft recommendation from the task force. Well, there's a lot of people out there saying, I don't think so. So it is a huge communication challenge. I think it's where we could learn a lot from colleagues in public health, who I think have always known probably more than clinical research types, just how vital this communication is. Because let's face it, the statistics represent real people who've been harmed by good intentions. And it's important that they know that, and yet you know, some estimates are between 33% and 40% of men who get a PSA test didn't know they were having it. I don't want to cut your time.
So I think Carolyn will be here for a couple questions at the end. Let's kind of mix this up a little bit. There's so many cool intersections between Avita's work and what Carolyn has just presented, and where I'm going to go with hopefully not too much rope to hang myself, but this is and this is sort of an acknowledgement. This is really a talk that sort of grows out of a brainstorm with a physician who is spending some time with us at Brigham, David Eidelman, who's chair of medicine and actually now the dean of McGill. And so here he is a specialist. He's a pulmonary specialist. I'm a generalist. He's a Canadian. I'm a U.S. doctor. And how do we think about resource use and diagnosis? And we've had this term conservative diagnosis that comes from conservative prescribing. We've recently published some papers, actually partly off of some of the ARC-funded work in the September Archives of Internal Medicine. But this is an attempt to see if any of this makes sense in terms of ways of talking about diagnosis. And I think this, like many other curves that we could show, really illustrates what's going to be in our face is a very serious issue and constraint. And this is the growth of diagnostic testing. This is the red bar here is imaging, and this is overall diagnostic tests. This is relative to all the rest of the medical costs and numbers rising, which obviously are also rising in themselves. And this is a recent ACP internist. Are there too many CT scans? And look at the rise of CT scans. Again, this is just up to 2005. I think the curve is not flattened one bit here. And even consumers are getting into this questioning about overdiagnosis and overtreatment. Here they're asking, if you go to the Consumer Reports website, tell us about a diagnostic lab test or CT scan that you had that you found was questionable, you didn't need. So why do we need this kind of approach to diagnosis? Number one, I think we have to really approach this looming debate and growing debate of it being about doing the right thing for the right reason. The idea of this is not to just deny people tests to hold down costs, but and to the extent it is, I think we can't fool the patients. So if we're telling the patients we're doing this for their own good and all this, when it really is merely for an insurance company to save money or someone else to save money, it's not going to get the kind of buy-in and partnership that Carolyn talked about and we're going to use as a centerpiece of this talk. So it's really not about just doing fewer tests but more appropriate testing. It has to be based on respecting the clinical uncertainties that drive our work, actually both as clinicians as well as patients. The challenges, the anxieties that patients feel when they don't know what's wrong with them and the diagnosis. And I want to contrast that to what I would say is sort of the kind of the wrong road to go up, and maybe that's what mainly I want to do here. You know, this is what are the factors driving utilization, costs are covered by third-party public or private payers. These factors leave both doctors and patients with no incentive to restrain healthcare prices or use. So just that we've given people health insurance and a blank check, and this is inevitably what's going on, and people even go so far as saying we shouldn't have health insurance because that's what's behind all this. And I would say a lot of this sort of thinking is summarized, and obviously this slide is an oversimplification, but I think does represent the reality of what we're going to have to think about very clearly about what are the current approaches, and I would call them misguided approaches, high deductible health plans. We just heard about a Walmart $5,000 deductible health plan. That's not unusual these days. That'll force people to think twice about getting that CT scan, right? Co-pays, co-insurance, multi-tier insurance things. So, you know, if you want to pay more, you can get this stuff if you're rich enough, but we'll ration according to ability to pay. Utilization review and prior authorization, which is sort of the bane of the existence of primary care physicians. Many of the insurance companies, when they've looked at it carefully, find they invest. I think there was a study, United Healthcare put $100 million into utilization management, weren't saving any money for the cost of it. Blaming the patients. The patients are all running to the doctors for a hangnail and wanting a CT scan. blaming physicians because they're really not sure what to do, and so they're over-testing as a result of that. And then cutting access. Obviously, if patients don't get their foot in the door, then they're never going to order all these tests. So that's the way to really hold down these costs. And malpractice caps. So we'll stop practicing defensive medicine. We'll take away patients' right to sue when something bad has happened. Again, each of these is a much longer discussion, but let me just quickly lay those out and contrast those to, I think, the ideas that Dr. Edelman and I generated in thinking about this, about what would it really take to take a more conservative approach to this. And just in a few minutes before this lecture was loaded up, I came across a matrix by Avitus Dhanabedian that turns out, in a haunting way, summarizes the whole thing sort of in a blinded way from even having seen this and thinking about this. But number one, continuity relationships. So if somebody knows the patient, you're coming to the emergency room, somebody has chest pain. I have dozens of patients that come to the emergency room with chest pain who I would never in a million years think about doing a big workup on them. They have a lot of psychosocial issues, substance issues, other causes for chest pain, but really are not patients that somebody who would know them intimately would spend a lot of money working them up in the emergency room. Longitudinal follow-up, so really having a relationship actually facilitates just the logistics of following up in primary care. Then there's the trust. I mean, the patients are going to tell me the truth about, you know, that they've relapsed on substance abuse or this is an STD situation that they're concerned about. Informational continuity, again, a much bigger subject, but we all know that if you don't have access to previous results, you're going to end up making bad decisions, not just repeating tests, but just and how to do that and how to deal with the fact that information overload is an equal problem now as all this information gets online. Fewer drop balls, again, with these relationships. So it really needs to be done right, compassionate and thorough. And to do this as a primary care physician, I actually need the capacity to support me and being able to have this continuity relationship to practice conservative diagnosis. This is this notion that the patients have to be involved. This is from a New Orleans poster. Nothing about us without us is for us. And again, we heard that in several slides of Carolyn's, as well as the quote from Dhanabedian. But this idea about the diagnostic alliance, we were talking about, you know, this idea about forming a therapeutic alliance with the patient, and we were trying to think about what it meant to form a diagnostic alliance, which I think has to be a sort of a new term based on the understanding that the diagnosis, exactly as Tudor Hart and Carolyn quoted, is co-produced by the patient and the physician or the clinician. So it's not that the patients are the consumers and I'm the expert and I make the diagnosis, and it really is something that based on all sorts of information sharing and behavior working together, we come up with a diagnosis together. And what's the key? Trust, continuity, and time are the key to unlock this this relationship. Again, these are sort of broad stroke ideas, in some ways almost common sense, but you can see it's swimming upstream with some of the things that are happening. The next thing, really, I think, is a quote from Osler. It's 19th century, but listen to your patient. He is telling you the diagnosis. So, you know, we do this all the time when we teach our residents. You got to take a good history, listen to the patient, not go on fourth-hand information or rushed history-taking. But, you know, one is learning from the patient's history, making that history match the actual syndrome. We're coming up with diagnoses, you know, because something you find on an x-ray or a lab test, it have nothing to do with the way the patient is clinically presenting. And so matching that to the patient's syndrome, building a relationship to be able to trust the history. I mean, I've heard, I remember working at Cook County Jail, people said you can't trust anything they say. These people are all a bunch of liars, you know, just miss everything they say. It turns out it wasn't even true in that setting, and hopefully in a good continuity, trusting relationship, that's not going to be the way you build this. You know, this idea about history being sort of an evolving thing, which again is related to the relationship thing. It's not a matter of you just do the H&P and then that's the end of it. You're going back to the patient, it's raising questions, it's an iterative thing, again, working together, and also understanding the context. You know, somebody comes in and they're homeless, they have a set of symptoms that mean something different than somebody who's never, and somebody who is chronically complaining. Time, And time works in all sorts of critical ways here in terms of conservative diagnosis. I think the first one is really having enough time for clinical encounters. There was a study I saw recently that they looked at throughput for emergency medicine doctors. The ones that saw 6 patients an hour versus 3 patients an hour. So there were some doctors, you know, you look at the variation and obviously you say, what's wrong with these slowpoke doctors? We have a backed up emergency room, it's overcrowded. They got to get these patients through here quickly. The ones who saw 6 patients an hour ordered twice as many CT scans. So, you know, what does that mean? There's a lot to talk about and think about in that kind of study. This whole idea about the test of time and watchful waiting, actually this is a term probably came about from prostate care with people who had enlarged prostate. But this idea about we're not really sure what the diagnosis is. It doesn't look like anything serious, but we're gonna provide a safety net and watch you. Serial versus parallel testing. This idea about instead of running all tests at once, let's get one and let's see what it happens and let's go slowly. Obviously, if somebody is in shock and has a half hour to live, That's not the right thing to advocate. But many patients, especially with chronic problems, we should be going sequentially, and that's a much more conservative approach. And when does getting the right diagnosis faster really make sense is the best strategy, and we should help define those. Follow-up is another key thing for practicing conservative diagnosis, and almost it's run through all the other preceding bullets. But we need a new science of uncertainty. We need to be able to send the patient home and I say, I'm not 100% sure there's nothing wrong with you. You know, the x-ray is normal, but, you know, a CT might pick up something that we're missing. But for all intents and purposes, there's no harm. And let's just watch how you do. And let's just see what happens. So building these safety nets to protect and mitigate against diagnostic errors and delays, again, putting an open line, not go home, there's nothing wrong with you, don't call me again, we're going to charge you a big copay if you dare to come back or bother me. Feel free, the lower the threshold for people getting back in. You don't have to come back to Cook County Hospital and wait in another 24-hour line and go through it all over again. Let's just make it easy. Create pull systems. Give patients our cell phone numbers just to reassure them and also reassure us that we can safely send them home and they're not going to have a problem getting back in. Patient education, negotiating so the patients understand and buy in. Diagnosing what matters. So we should be focusing on what's treatable and obviously the critical don't miss things that are, we have a list of diagnostic considerations and try to move up to the top of the list, you know, spinal epidural infection that's going to paralyze somebody if you don't make that diagnosis quickly and treat it quickly. But many other things don't have that degree of urgency or aren't treated, and it's not as a priority. What's the patient's context? You know, a 90-year-old man, do they need colorectal colonoscopy screening if they have other competing diagnoses? Early diagnosis, again, a two-edged sword. Actually, I want to give you a quote from this month's ARP magazine, which, believe it or not, I'm a subscriber for many years. Some physicians worry that all the talk about early Alzheimer's diagnosis and the new biomarker test is getting ahead of the science and could unleash a wave of premature diagnosis and of a devastating disease with no cure. So yes, maybe we can get a few little inklings, earlier diagnosis of Alzheimer's, but is that a good idea? So what will that do for us? When to escalate. Harm from diagnosis. Say, okay, these tests can't. We might as well, just to be safe, let's order a lot of tests. Can't hurt you. First thing we have to really keep emphasizing is the real harms from radiation exposure. Rebecca Byman, Smith Byman, has recently testified before Congress. You know, the number of CTs has gone from 1 in 5 people now gets one annually. And I hate to say it, I've had 2 CTs in the last year and a half myself. You know, and so it's, which, you know, both of which I couldn't believe I was ending up with, but here I am. But the radiation exposure is considerable. It's somewhere between 1,500 and 5,000 fold the radiation of a dental x-ray. So that's Carolyn's dentist is being trumped here. And this is the plain x-ray even is being exceeded by 100 to 500 fold. So population exposure is radically increased. It could be as high as 1 in 100 risk of cancer from some of the doses that we're using for CT, especially in younger age population, pediatric. And again, even the radiologists who have some financial vested interest in ordering more of these tests are getting into this of trying to get people to use less imaging. Harm from diagnosis could also be from things like contrast renal failure, psychologic trauma, false positive results. But the main thing that I think we ought to be thinking about and emphasizing to patients, helping them understand, is this problem of incidental findings. We discussed a case in JAMA this spring about this, and this is actually my reference here is Wikipedia. If it's overdiagnosis, I just heard it. You flunk your term paper if you quote Wikipedia. But here I am here. So don't run that term paper program, Joel, on my slides here, which I heard about. What's it called? Intern? What is it?
Turn it in.
Turn it in. All right. Well, turn me in here. Diagnosis is that will never cause symptoms or death during a patient's lifetime. This is the least familiar side effect of testing, but arguably the most important. It turns people into patients. So somebody was a person before, but now they're a patient. And I love this quote. This is from a Dr. Davis, who was at our PNHP meeting Saturday. She said, "You go from ease," she's a radiologist, "to dis-ease." So people now are, you know, didn't really think there was anything wrong with them. They weren't worried particularly, and suddenly you get these incidental findings, and you have dis-ease. Leads to unnecessary treatment that can cause harm, obviously, people going to surgery, having additional tests. And then understanding the limits of the tests, how we understand them, how we apply them. On the most basic level, it's, you know, what you learn in medical school, sensitivity, specificity, predictive value, but really in a much more rich and, I think, meaningful way, what are the thresholds at which you do these tests, and how do you interpret them, and decision rules related to patient utilities. Again, a longer discussion, but I think this has to be on the awareness for conservative use of diagnostic work. Situational awareness of all the things that can go wrong with these tests, losing the results, perforating somebody's colon with an unnecessary colonoscopy, and then again circling back to uncertainty when you get these results. Technology assessment, and again, this is what Carolyn's mandate is, to do comparative effectiveness, although they can only scratch the surface for all the tests that are out there and all the different situations. What's the marginal impact of doing a biliary scan on top of a biliary ultrasound on top of an MRI, and repeat testing, when should tests be repeated? We're hearing a lot about people having multiple CTs in the course of 6 months. And this is something that was a classic article. I think I had even met Carolyn at the Society for Medical Decision Making. This was a paper presented by some folks there. And again, I use this as part of my teaching with the residents. We don't have time to go this in detail, but people think you put up an X-ray and you can see something and it looks really cool. Sharp as day, very, you know, instead of a 5-millimeter resolution, we now have a 1-millimeter resolution. It's in color. It's very evident. That's a good test. That's an efficacious test. Well, does it really improve the diagnostic accuracy? We have to ask that question. And these are the kind of questions that are raised there. Does it really change your diagnosis in the end of the day? So, okay, it's got a high sensitivity and specificity before the test. You thought the person had, you know, pneumococcal pneumonia. And then after the test, you're still thinking the same. Does it change how you're treating the patient? That's the next level as we go up this hierarchy. Is it helpful? Does it change what you're ordering for the patient, different drug or different surgery? But that really isn't enough either. You really want to know whether it makes a difference in terms of patient outcomes, morbidity or mortality, or what's the benefit above and beyond not doing the test. And then finally, okay, so we got a good test and it saves lives. You know, we can do head CTs and everyone who has a headache, and we'll find brain tumors and save a life. But is it really worth it to invest that versus investing that money in something else? Because it's only, you know, 1 in 100,000 people that we would be able to have that kind of efficacy with. Avoiding financial conflicts, as we circle back to those bad, misguided ideas, there's a lot of them embodied in a lot of financial conflict embodied in that, including putting me at risk for patients. So I try and tell this patient, you shouldn't have a head CT scan. And every time I say no, I get a $500 bonus, or my pool at the end of the year is increased. How confident and trusting is that for the patient believing I'm giving them the right information. Patients having skin in the game, that's sort of even more pernicious, longer discussion. And then almost at the end here, how to really lower the threshold for me getting help when I'm really not certain. So this idea about making it harder for me to consult, I ought to be able to pick up the phone. Certainly in dermatology, I would just love to pick up the phone and hold up my iPhone and maybe they can't even make the exact diagnosis, but they know, should I be worrying? Can I try steroids? What am I missing here? Same holds true with getting even some of these triage decisions. So lowering the barriers, not increasing the barriers for access to specialists and help. And then finally, this whole male practice boogeyman, where my fellow clinicians would say, this is all nice stuff, but we have to practice defensive medicine because the lawyers are going to get us unless we run all these tests. And it's certainly true, and that we want to start by saying there is a lot of malpractice, and there's a number one cause of malpractice claims. This is dollars, and this is cases, is diagnosis. So we hear a lot about treatment and surgical errors, infections, but this is diagnosis errors that dominates. And it turns out a lot of this, especially in the outpatient setting, is cancer by a factor of 10 to 1 to the next ones. And again, colorectal, prostate. So we have to think about this. We were just told, don't get PSAs routinely, okay? But look, we're missing prostate cancer. How are we going to put all this together and work this out with the patients and get their informed consent? The first thing I would say about this is if you draw a PSA, you damn well better follow it up and not leave it in the chart on notice. And I think a lot, in fact, I've looked at a number of these cases here, are result from that kind of negligence. But these are tough ones. And thinking about cancer, and this is really the last slide till we sum up, we're never going to diagnose cancer when the first cell divides, erratically. So cancer is always a delayed diagnosis. And, the question is sort of how do we think about this and how do we work this out and how do we make a difference without, doing this imaging, every 10 minutes to try to diagnosis when the first cell divides. So in conclusion, conservative diagnosis, first and foremost, has to be a way of respecting our patients and our own limits as clinicians. It's not fundamentally about saying no. I don't think we can ignore patients' legitimate fears or clinical uncertainties. Rather, it's a way of saying yes, enabling, helping them, providing safety nets, creating a new science of collaboration around uncertainty. And then this was the slide of Donna Bedian that I just found this morning, that kind of puts it all together. This is what he called his 3x4 quality matrix. So this is the famous structure, process, outcome. We all know about that. But he went and put on the up and down axis here on the rows, access. So we talked about people being able to access physicians. Technical quality, relationship quality, affect relationship quality, and continuity of care. So in an uncanny way, I think Avitus figured all this out, certainly ahead of me, and that's I think quite helpful in putting it all together. So thank you. So we have 10 minutes, 9 minutes. People want to raise a question or two, mainly to Carolyn. If anybody had more questions, I know we cut some off. Yeah, go ahead there. Yeah. I guess you probably need to come to the mic, Carolyn, yeah.
And maybe you need to repeat the question.
Oh, yeah. He said, we love what you're doing. How do we support that? I think the more you can speak up for this and speak up in particular that this is a team sport and that this includes the patients would be very, very helpful. At the end of the day, I don't see this as particularly partisan or one-sided. I can't think of anyone who wants to get bad care. The great irony of our work in comparative effectiveness is that our authority derives from a provision in the Medicare Modernization Act, also known as the Part D bill, sponsored by Senator Frist. Not that it's like actually being recognized or recalled that way at the moment, but I think it's very relevant because to be a collaborator, to have a collaborative relationship with patients around uncertainty, they need to be informed. And, you know, that means dealing with and understanding the context of beliefs, fears, and so forth that Gordy so eloquently described.
Yes.
I'm Mike Gary. My background is with the Child Death Review Teams that are now in multiple countries. The project at the moment involves trying to build systems in hospitals to automate the child abuse reports. Today, they don't know how many in the case, much less what, and that's agreeable with investigators that don't want to be bothered with lots of information. How do I position this work with child abuse with the healthcare industry? Get us tied to, we're building something I think of logical value, but I can't figure out where to attach myself.
Well, I guess I would say, you know, one of the great transitions that we're making in healthcare now, and this applies to public health as well, is that we're moving from this kind of paper-based memory world to one that is much more data-based, you know, where we can call that up. And when I tried to explain the issues around reporting on patient safety to the last Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mike Leavitt, who really was not familiar with any of this. I mean, every bit of it was news to him. The Institute of Medicine, no. I mean, that just was not part of it. In fact, I had to teach a lot of people in the last administration what the Institute of Medicine was, but they learned. What he got was this idea of how do you separate signal from noise in reporting. He said, you know, we passed a law in Utah one year that mandated reporting, and suddenly we saw this dramatic uptick. And I don't really believe that there was a dramatic uptick in occurrence. Maybe there was, but we don't know the difference. And I thought that was a pretty adroit kind of idea. So I would see this organization and other similar scientific organizations as a place where people come together to try to figure out how do you interpret that, and frankly, how do you act on it? What's a threshold for action? Because and I will say in the quality world right now, we're much, much better at collecting data and making report cards and websites than we are at figuring out what is the practical approach. I mean, I would just point you to infections, right? We've been counting them and detailing them and studying them for years, and we know a whole lot about genetic mechanisms of resistance and all that kind of stuff, all of which is important. But actually, what in God's name do you do with this constant background level that is way too high? That's where we were able to make a dent.
I have just a 10-second answer. We need to go from reporting to recording. It just should be part of our routine work and figure out how to capture that electronically, as Carolyn said, and as well as then something has to happen positively about that, not threatening or help us protect the child or learn from it.
The captive regulations allow people to talk to each other. In the end, the trouble is this barrier goes up and says, don't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
Thank you, I feel better.
All right, Claudia.
You know, I hesitate to ask this question because it's something that always troubles me about quality. You know, all of this is, to me, about communication. And, you know, if you look at when you talk to a patient and the physician and the patient are in the room, and they leave the room and you ask the physician what just transpired, and you ask the patient what just transpired, that disconnect between the two. So we're really good at measuring the data and counting things. So I'm focused on these value-based purchasing that's coming down the pipe and how we're going to compensate. And my concern is that we're more focused on recording the information and data as opposed to the solution part and trying to give empowering physicians and organizations in terms of how they resolve these problems, how they make that leap. So we're going to start counting things that may not actually reflect what we're really trying to accomplish going forward.
No, I think that is a huge, huge challenge, and I also think some of it, particularly coming from the physician side, some of it actually gets worse as we start to do better. You know, highly informed people who want okay, but not superlative control of diabetes, you know, that is actually a choice. Now, you know, there's a world of biomedical correctness where actually saying that out loud is very uncomfortable. And I know a lot of those folks. In a world where you're counting stuff, but actually working that out with the patient in terms of what are your real goals here and so forth, we would say that's patient-centered care. You know, as we get better and better at diabetes metrics, I mean, for so long we were so bad at any aspect of it, like even checking the results, that kind of thing, that like this was, you know, distantly theoretical. It's coming a bit more into focus right now, and I get very, very worried about a lot of the quality metrics that are check the box, right? I'd much rather know that there were legions of people out there saying, tell me what you heard, play that back to me. I want to make sure that you and I are actually on the same page, which I'm looking at my good friend David nodding here. And I think, frankly, it's more common in the mental health and behavioral health communities than it is in the physical health, where we're so used to hard data that I don't think there's a physician anywhere who doesn't know the joke of walking into an intensive care unit with somebody you say to, you know, the patient is really having a hard time breathing, and somebody says, but their SWAN numbers are fine. Yeah. Wait a minute.
Let's do one more question, and then we'll let people come up. Yeah.
Helen, as you were talking...
Stand up if you don't mind.
Insurance from Mental Health America. I was remembering that the you know, Academy Health was originally part of the American Public Health Association, and it spun off and became a very successful independent organization. I'm just curious if you think about, because I noticed some of the ways I thought you were trying to position some of your slides around a public health theme, think about some of the traditional tensions certainly between medicine and public health, if there are some. How do you see health services research as kind of spanning that gap or the sort of a rapprochement, if you will, among what has been sort of different approaches to the overall problem of health?
So I'll just say briefly, when I came into work at ARC, Academy Health, or what was then an association, was somewhat separate, but the medical care section here at APHA was like the place to be every year. You know, the Association for Health Services Research was okay, but that just felt like insider baseball. You know, with new leadership at Academy Health in the form of Lisa Simpson, who gets public health in a big way, I would hope that we could build some bridges back, because it's no accident that Nikki Lurie is actually the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, because she took a lot of these skills and tools that she used to apply in quality to trying to figure out, was all this money that was being thrown at people for bioterrorism actually helping or not? And, you know, what she found was just like clinical care. There were local health departments that were doing unbelievably well, that could reach like 98% of the practicing clinicians in their community by email and da-da-da-da, and others where, you know, you'd leave a phone message about botulism and no one would even get back to you for 48 hours. And, you know, so I think there's way more commonalities than that, but I come back to, what goal are we trying to achieve? And if improving chronic illness care and reducing chronic illness, period, is on that list, we got to work together. So again, I really want to thank people for being here. I'm going to have to run.
Yeah, but, no.
That was exciting. That was exciting. I'm going to have to follow up with you because I missed you.